Today is June 5th, 2019. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Photography can capture the most significant moments of our history, and these make for iconic photos. The raising of the flag on Iwo Jima is an iconic photograph taken by Joe Rosenthal on February 23, 1945, which depicts six U.S. Marines raising the U.S. flag atop of Mount Suribachi during the Battle of Iwo Jima in World War II. Then there is also the ecstatic sailor shown kissing a woman in Times Square, celebrating the end of World War II on VJ Day. Do you remember where you were 30 years ago in 1989? June 5th, 1989. An unidentified man stands alone in the street, blocking a column of Chinese tanks. He remains there for several minutes before being pulled away by onlookers. Tank Man was a lone protester who brought a column of tanks to a standstill during a crackdown on pro-democracy protesters at Tiananmen Square in Beijing in 1989. He refused to move out of the way and climb onto the leading tank to speak to the driver. He was later pulled away from the scene by two men. What happened to him remains unknown. A promotional video for camera company Leica has sparked backlash in China for featuring this famous Tiananmen Square image. People on Chinese social media, Weibo, have called for a boycott of the camera ban. Beginning with the caption, Beijing 1989, the Leica video features a photographer taking the famous image. The tank man can be seen in the camera's lens. Users on Chinese social media site Weibo have been forbidden from commenting. Chinese technology giant Huawei has been restricted by the U.S. and other countries over security concerns in telecommunications networks. Consumers in China have rallied around the company, which uses Leica technology in the latest mobile phones. A spokeswoman for Leica told the South China Morning Post that the film was not an officially sanctioned marketing film commissioned by the company. However, it features Leica cameras and the camera's logo at the end of the footage. They added that the company must therefore distance itself from the content shown in the video, and they regret any misunderstandings of false conclusions that may have been drawn. China has banned all activist commemorations of the 1989 Tiananmen Square incident for years and has strictly regulated online discussion of it. If users search for Tiananmen on domestic search engines like Baidu or social media platforms like Weibo, they only see sunny pictures of Forbidden City in Beijing. If any pictures of tanks running along Chang'an Avenue are visible in image searches, they are only from Victory Day parades. More than 1 million Chinese students and workers occupied Tiananmen Square in 1989, beginning the largest political protest in Communist China's history. 6 weeks of protests ended with a bloody crackdown on the protesters in June. Estimates of the death toll range from several hundred to more than 1,000. China's statement at the end of June 1989 said that 200 civilians and several dozen security personnel had died in Beijing following the suppression of counter-revolutionary riots starting with the 4th of June 1989. Hundreds of references to the 4th of June 1989 are banned all year round by thousands of cyber police, with Weibo steps up censorship of even seemingly innocuous references to the incidents on its anniversary. Simple candle emoji and the number sequences that reference to the date, such as the numbers 46 and 64, which stands for the 4th of June or June 4th, and the number 1989, the year of the protest, are instantly deleted. Small businesses also had to struggle with items on the 4th of June every year if their sale price ends in 46 or 64 yuan. Such advertising posts are swiftly removed by nervous censors. Unfortunately, most iconic photographs of history are negative. The first such image that had an impact on me was in early 1940 of a picture of a Japanese soldier bayoneting a Chinese baby during the rape of Nanjing. I recently did an internet search on this and found that there were postings claiming that the photograph was Photoshopped and claiming that the rape of Nanjing just didn't happen. Hey, the ability and the technology in the 1940s to Photoshop a picture they weren't available at all. Unless you live through it, this mixture of real and fake news have blurred a line of historical facts. There was a news article in the New York Times on January 22nd in 1997 titled, "A Japanese Generation Haunted by Its Past." Nearly six decades have passed, but when Shinzaburo Hori sees a baby, he still cringes inside, and his mind replays the indelible scene of himself as a young soldier in China, thrusting his bayonet through the chest of a Chinese infant. Mr. Hori says the killing was unintentional, but the memories follow him everywhere, and he has never mustered the courage to even tell his wife. He said, "My story is nothing to be proud of," said Mr. Hori, who was deeply agitated as he spoke about his role in the war, "so I don't think I should talk too much about it." While many Japanese argue that there is no need for the country as a whole to apologize to overseas war victims or compensate them, many veterans say the government should do more to show remorse for the war and to teach young people about atrocities committed by Japanese troops. "We should absolutely apologize to China and Korea," Mr. Hori said without hesitation. "Absolutely." The tension was thick as he began to peel away his own memories, and his hand shook like dry leaves in the wind. "The killing of the baby," Mr. Hori insisted, "it was just as accidental." He said he had been searching a village for anti-Japanese guerrillas when he saw a stack of dried reeds with an arm sticking out holding a gun. "I charged with my bayonet and thrust it into the reeds at chest height, and I heard a scream," he said. "I pulled a rifle out, and there was a baby skewered on the bayonet. It was maybe 6 months old, and the hilt had gotten caught in its belt, so it was stuck to the bayonet. It turned out that the baby's mother was a gorilla, holding the baby as she hid in the reeds. The bayonet had gone through her as well as the baby, so she died too." Mr. Hori paused, overcome by the rush of memories. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? You should know. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the phone number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your question or comment to hank@pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on the Google number 862-800-6805. Start your message with "The Personal Computer Show," followed by your message. This is a follow-up on last week's report that Baltimore got hit by the Robin Hood ransomware. The New York Times reported that those behind the Baltimore cyber attack that has left the city government without access to its computers since earlier this month used technology developed by the National Security Agency. The cyber attackers have demanded an undisclosed amount of money to unlock the machines. Per the Times, the NSA lost control of the tool Eternal Blue in 2017, and state hackers in North Korea, Russia, and China have used it to do billions of dollars in damage around the world. Eternal Blue was one government hacking program leaked to the public 2 years ago. The current cyber attack on the city of Baltimore has been tracked to a hacking tool developed by the National Security Agency to cripple foreign government in the past. Eternal Blue was once considered among the most valuable weapons in the NSA's cyber arsenal, and according to the New York Times, analysts spent nearly a year developing the malware to target a substantial flaw in Microsoft software, a flaw that was exploited countless times in intelligence gathering and counterterrorism operations. Because the tool was so useful to the NSA, it decided not to warn Microsoft about its vulnerability. That all changed in April of 2017 when a hacker group known as the Shadow Brokers released details about Eternal Blue and the vulnerability it was used to exploit. But the breach and leak, while widely reported to the public, did not result in the widespread repairs to the Microsoft vulnerabilities that were previously exploited. Although a patch was quickly rushed out by the tech company, cybersecurity operatives were slow to implement it, leaving thousands of systems around the world vulnerable to attack. Earlier this month, however, the Robinhood ransomware attack on Baltimore was initiated with the use of Eternal Blue. Now a number of other cities across the U.S. have been warned about the destructive malware. More than 1 million computers are still vulnerable, and new attacks are happening almost daily. All this raises the question, how did Baltimore back up their computer systems? I've been working in computer technology for almost 60 years, beginning with vacuum tubes to transistor technology to integrated circuits. The technology has evolved, but the basic principles of backup remains constant. Backup is the ability to roll back to a restart point, to the state of hardware and software, to a prior point to be able to continue running. What is needed is a replication of a processing site, availability of hardware, reconnecting all communication points, and restoring the state of the operating system and the library of data files. It is difficult to overstate the importance of having a rock-solid backup and recovery plan, although nearly every business has some form of backup plan in place. Many, however, failed to take all the necessary steps to ensure that plans will deliver when they need it most. If you have an exact image of the operating environment and data media from the prior day's processing, the most you have lost are transactional items that occurred from the night before the total system lost. What happened in Baltimore with the Robinhood ransomware attack could have been minimized. So why has restoration been so arduous? Who is responsible? In most enterprise organizations running computer applications, you have internal auditors and external audit firms to verify that all proper procedures have been implemented. Principles of data backup and recovery. With large enterprise systems, the time it takes to do a backup of all the data could take up the entire business day. So they do incremental backups of what was exactly changed during the course of the workday and a complete backup on the weekend. But for the home consumer and the small business operations, you can simplify the process of doing a total image backup after normal processing. Corporations identify alternative processing sites having the processing capability to take over the minimum needs to continue operation. Each night, the backed up data is stored off-site. For the home consumer, keep an updated list of your hardware and software configuration if there's a need to replicate the operating environment in a Windows operating system environment. You can run HWinfo, which is a third-party utility, and MSInfo32 on the command mode once a month. Save the printed output and put it in a safe place. Run the various product code recovery utilities whenever there is a new installation of a software license. This only needs to be done whenever there is a change. Generally, when we think of backing up data, we have databases in mind. However, associating data purely with databases can mislead us to thinking that as long as we have our databases backed up, then we're on safe ground. Unfortunately, this is far from the case. The truth is that some of your most important data exists outside of your database. If you're running a website, for example, in addition to your database, you will need to regularly back up the entire file directory that is in the cloud. Maintain and update all passwords used on hard copy. Leaving it on the computer will not work when it's needed and the system is not available. Test your backups periodically. You may know how to recover, but if it's not really accessed over a long period of time, the procedures, if not written and tested, may not be accurate or remembered. The only reliable way to guard against any of these dangers is to test your backups regularly. This is the part of your backup that requires the most discipline because it is the one step you generally can't automate and you must do manually. Naturally, you can't test your backups on your live environment. Therefore, part of the testing process will require having a development or staging environment that is identical to your live system. If there's any significant difference in the configuration, you may find it difficult or impossible to perform a complete test of your backup. There's an old principle among systems administrators. If the data doesn't exist in at least three separate locations, it doesn't exist at all. Many site owners prefer to keep one copy on site, one copy in a nearby physical location, and one copy in the cloud. However, your specific needs will depend on the type of data, your security concerns, and any rules surrounding various types of encryption and so on. Yet the general principle is to have a number of duplicates of your backups in physically separate secure locations. Do a review of your backup at least once a year. This is no different than reviewing your will or list of beneficiaries of some of your legal documents, like your insurance policies, periodically to make sure it is up to date. Google suspends Android updates and support for Huawei. Huawei has managed to establish itself as one of the prime manufacturers and a major innovator in the mobile imaging space within a very short period of time. However, Google, who is the maker of the Android mobile operating system that runs on pretty much all mobile devices, will stop working with Huawei on future Android updates and device certifications. The move is a reaction to an executive order signed by U.S. President Donald Trump and a resulting U.S. Commerce Department blacklist, which prohibits U.S. companies to do business with certain foreign entities, including Huawei. Huawei is accused by the Trump accusation to work with the Chinese government to install backdoors in its network equipment for spying purposes. Companies on the blacklist are barred from purchasing equipment from U.S. companies without prior government approval. Previously, Huawei devices had already been dropped by U.S. network carriers under political pressure, and Huawei is accused by the Trump accusation to work with the Chinese government to install backdoors in its network equipment for spying purposes. However, no proof of such practices has been published so far. The latest development is problematic for Huawei device division, insofar that it relies on Google for access to closed portions of the Android OS and the Play Services Suite. The latter has to be approved for each Android device. According to reports, Play Services won't be removed from existing devices, but no new certifications will be issued. That said, Huawei will be able to continue to use Huawei open source components. Huawei has issued an official response to the development, saying it will continue to provide security updates to all Huawei and Honor devices. Huawei will continue to provide security updates and after-sales services to all existing Huawei and Honor smartphone and tablet products, covering those that have been sold and that are still in stock globally. Google has also confirmed that Google Play Services and Play Protect will continue to work on existing Huawei devices. Other U.S. companies have joined Google in severing ties with Huawei. According to a report by Bloomberg, Intel, Qualcomm, and Broadcom will stop supplying their chips and modems to Huawei. The same for German chipmaker Infineon Technologies and U.S. memory chip suppliers Micron Tech and Western Digital. There is no word from Microsoft yet, but the software company is expected to cease supply of its Windows operating system for Huawei's range of laptops. Huawei is quite well protected against some of these impacts, as the company is designing and manufacturing chipsets, modems, and many other components in-house. It is also reported that the company has been stockpiling chips from U.S. supplies in anticipation of the current events. Supplies are said to last 3 months, which hopefully should be enough time to solve the situation. So what's going on with Huawei and Android? If you own a Huawei smartphone, you've probably been going through quite the emotional turmoil. Your choice of smartphone has seen you been placed on the front lines in a trade war and potential futuristic cyber war between the world's two prominent superpowers. It looks like your smartphone could be cut off from the official Google support, setting it adrift from the latest and greatest features, but also more importantly, nuts and bolts of security updates. So, exactly what's been going on? For anybody unfamiliar with Huawei, the Chinese manufacturer has grown to prominence recently thanks to its competitively priced and impressively featured lines of smartphones, the likes of the P30, the P30 Pro, the Mate 20 Pro and others, including the budget-friendly Honor range, have captured the market's attention and won a huge global following. YY phones come loaded with the manufacturer's own mobile operating system, Core EMUI or EMU, but like with almost all other smartphone manufacturers. Huawei's mobile operating system is based on Google's open-source Android. When Google suspended all business with Huawei, it meant that Huawei phones would no longer be able to receive data from Google. It isn't all about trade, though. Huawei also builds other things, namely 5G networks. 5G is the next generation of mobile telecommunication networks. The increase in data speeds would be so significant that 5G networks will be able to facilitate things that until now have been seen impossible. The U.S. government is concerned that it could be Chinese technology that sits at the heart of it all. The United States have been exerting pressure on its allies not to have Huawei install 5G networks in their countries. Over the last couple of days, there have been a number of developments. First off, Google has said that Huawei phones will still be able to access services like Google Play, even while Google tries to comply with the U.S. government. Since then, Huawei has said itself that it will keep providing security updates to its customers. The best news, however, has come from the U.S. Commerce Department, which has granted a 90-day temporary license to Huawei that restores the ability to provide updates to its customers. This license does not allow Huawei to keep selling new Android phones, however, which shows that there are still major problems underlying the whole issue. So if you own a Huawei phone, you're off the hook for now for the next couple of months. Well, then let's see what happens. In a long-running court case between Apple and Qualcomm with suits and countersuits, it was settled a few weeks ago. But guess what happened? U.S. District Judge Lucy Cole of the Northern District of California handed down a sweeping win to the FTC in its antitrust suit against Qualcomm, calling out the wireless giant's lawyer executives as the architects, implementers, and enforcers of anti-competitive practices. What she did was, she said, "I don't care, you settled. It's not a settlement." Qualcomm struck a $100 million deal with Samsung last year to extinguish Samsung's antitrust claims and to silence Samsung. Cole's finding of fact and conclusion of law culminate in a bench trial held earlier this year in the Federal Trade Commission versus Qualcomm. There is research and development battle over the future of the 5G chip that are behind the Internet of Things. Qualcomm, a mid-sized San Diego, California-based company, is the company which developed both the 3G and 4G chip, which have transformed handheld phones into mobile communication devices. Qualcomm's research is paid for by the licensing revenues they receive from phone manufacturers like Apple for the technological innovations that make the iPhone do amazing thing it does. Apple and Qualcomm have been in dispute over the licensing fee. Under the previous administration, the Federal Trade Commission filed legal action to end Qualcomm's licensing stream, denying the company the earned revenue that is necessary to fund the development of the next generation of chip. However, the two parties had just settled prior to the U.S. District Judge ruling, and instead of the judge dismissing the contested case, the judge ruled against the intellectual property rights of Qualcomm. This threatens to wreak havoc against the basic private property rights of Qualcomm, with the primary beneficiary being, guess who? China's Huawei. U.S. District Judge Lucy Cole of the Northern District of California ruled that Qualcomm must license some of its industry-essential patents to rival chip suppliers. Qualcomm illegally hurt competitors in the wireless chip market and used its dominant position to force unnecessary licensing fees on handset, something it previously refused to do, which means Qualcomm must have to forego royalties of 5% of sales price up to $400 on handsets and instead assess fees based on the $15 to $20 for the chip. The truth is that Qualcomm's competitor, China's Huawei, was called as a lead witness by the FTC in the case. Huawei has been found to have been receiving funds from the Chinese intelligence services, and they cannot be allowed to win the race in creating the chips behind the next generation of internet communications due to obvious security concerns. And at a time when the U.S. government is aggressively seeking to cut this Chinese company out of the U.S. tech arena, a federal judge in the Bay Area of California decides to legally hamstring Qualcomm's revenue stream to win the race on the critical 5G chip. Contact your elected congressional representatives to appeal to the FTC to agree to a reasonable settlement, agree to the one already reached between Apple and Qualcomm. Otherwise, we're just handing the technology over to Huawei. And we want to stop them at the same time we're giving it to them? Illogical. Benjamin will be presenting in his continuing series, Finding an IT Professional.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and I'm here to give you some benefit from my experience of being an IT professional for, we'll just say, many years. This week, I'm giving you some basic tips on finding someone who can serve as your IT professional. Now, this can apply in a number of different areas. Maybe it's just you and you've got some personal usage. Maybe you've got a small office, home office kind of situation. Or maybe, yes, you're in a company, small company that's growing and knows they need an IT professional full time. All of these different things combined together in the same way. Now, like a doctor, you want the best in your doctor. So these wind up being very similar. So I'm going to go through each of these and hopefully you'll tie them back just the same way. Good references and character. First and foremost, when we talk about character, we talk about your interests first. We talk not so much about tech, not because others do it, but because you need it. So if I were making a pitch to you for me to be your IT professional, I'm going to ask you questions. I'm going to interact with you. I'm going to suggest things based on your needs and your interests, not because I want to sell you something, not because it's the coolest, hippest thing out there. No, it's going to be because you need it. I'm also going to be willing to tell you what you need to hear. I'm going to tell you this even if it's hard, even if it's difficult. Now, don't get me wrong. Sometimes we, as nerds, we don't like confrontation. It's hard for me to tell you that. That's how much we try to avoid confrontation. We also want to have good references on any IT professional that's going to be working for us. So you want to make sure that other people out there like your IT professional of choice. They like what he does and they say, yes, he does follow along with many of these different things. So the next one, goals are aligned with yours. Now, that's kind of in that same character thing. However, they should want you to succeed. They should want your business to become better. They should want your computer to become better. They should be out there for you when you need it. Now, they should be relating to your goals. They should be finding out your goals. They should be relating to your journey forward. They want you to be successful in that journey. They want to tackle your issues, but not bring up different other ideas that are going to derail your journey, to throw you off in a different direction. So part of this is being a good communicator. All right, and all of this is related to each other. You'll notice that so many of these different things tie into each other, and I'm just putting them in different directions because good communicator, even though it's part of telling you the hard things, part of it is all of these other items, but we still need to focus in on these. So when I say good communicator, I mean that that IT professional must be able to explain some of the basic things for you in plain English. There's no techno babble. There is no jargon. There's no like different phrases or words that you're listening to and you go, I know those words and I don't understand how they work together. And I feel like I'm watching Star Trek. You know, it shouldn't be like that. Additionally, they should be interacting with you. They should be checking in to ensure that you understand, but they should also be showing signs that they understand you. that they understand your problems. They understand your goals. How do we know this? I can't go and elicit this. I should be hearing back the same things that I've said. I should be hearing the same concerns that I've expressed. I should be hearing back what I want to hear. This is if I'm interviewing them. So you see how that works? Yeah, I do that a lot. So problem solver. Now, you have problems, and your IT professional should be able to solve those. But you want to look for how they have overcome issues that are similar to yours. You want to look for creativity. You want to look for that imagination, that outside-of-the-box thinking. You also want to listen. You want to search for a background of similar clients that have similar concerns, that have similar issues. All of these things should be indicating that this person right here is going to be working towards solving my problems, not creating new ones, not creating solutions where solutions aren't needed, and so forth. Lastly, experience in what you need. I have a talent of delivering where I have reduced experience, but I'm a quick study and I adapt to situations. Many technicians do not. Most technicians do not. So you want to make sure that they have experience. You want to make sure that they have a history of providing in the same kind of direction that you want. For instance, if you want to move to paperless, you should find somebody who has an experience with paperless offices. If you want to move into the Mac world, you should be finding someone who has a history, a long history of Mac experience. Likewise, you're not going to go to a Mac person for Windows experience. So this all matches together. This all rings together. So I'm going to run those back by you one more time. You're looking for good references in character. You're looking that the goals are aligned with yours. You're looking for a good communicator, a problem solver, someone who has experience in what you need. Again, just like looking for a new doctor. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Never say never. Amazon may be returning to New York for their second headquarters.
Start spreading the news. You're leaving today. Tell them, Frank.
I want to be a part of it. New York, New York.
Your vagabond shoes, they are longing to stray
and step around the heart of it. New York, New York. I want to wake up in that city that doesn't sleep
and find your king of the hill, top of the heap. Your small town blues, they're melting away.
I'm gonna make a brand new start of it in old New York.
You always make it there. You make it anywhere.
It's up to you.
Amazon coming back to New York as a headquarter, well, there's a chance it may happen again. Dateline, November 13th, 2018. Amazon officially selects Long Island City for new headquarters and will build around Annabel Basin. Dateline, February 14th, 2019. That's Valentine's Day. Amazon pulls out a plan to build New York City headquarters after backlash. And the dateline, May 27th, 2019, Amazon is eyeing a return to New York City. What has happened? The deal was that the state and city offered nearly $3 billion in public subsidies in exchange for the company bringing in at least 25,000 jobs and other investments. Amazon agreed to make some local hires and to fund some tech education. It did not agree to change its longstanding opposition to unionizing its workforce. The money? Supporters of the plan said New York would eventually reap more than $27 billion in tax revenue. Critics, however, questioned that number and said the money spent on subsidies should have been spent on improving housing and mass transit. So what happened? Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez came to power by unseating a high-ranking incumbent in a congressional district that includes parts of Queens near Long Island City. So when she opposed this deal, lawmakers took notice and her supporters helped organize protests of Amazon's project and helped block one of the biggest companies in the country. Who's to blame? Well, Governor Andrew M. Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio, both Democrats, are longtime rivals. But they joined forces to support this deal. When Amazon pulled out, they went back to feuding. Bill de Blasio blamed the company for leaving, and Governor Cuomo blamed Senate Democrats whose leadership questioned the deal. And the people? Well, a majority of the Queens residents supported the deal, according to a Quinnipiac University opinion poll in December. The owner of a popular restaurant in New York City had said, "I know the people who actually need these jobs, and I know the businesses who are going to suffer because of this." So what does the future hold? Lawmakers from Staten Island to Dutchess County said they welcome Amazon. Governor Cuomo's honeymoon with Senate Democrats seems finished, and Bill de Blasio is trying to put Amazon behind him and recoup his image as a progressive leader. He's also running for President of the United States. Or at least he's trying to get the nomination from the Democratic Party. After walking away from a deal to build a headquarters on Queens waterfront in Long Island City, Amazon is back to shopping for office space on Manhattan's west side. And this is as reported by the New York Post. The tech giant has been in talks with owners of two shiny new skyscrapers, located just one block west of Penn Station. The newly built One Manhattan West and the soon-to-be sister project, Two Manhattan West. The online retailer is seeking at least 100,000 square feet or much more. Amazon, which already has 5,000 workers in New York City, has been seriously looking at Two Manhattan West prior to choosing Long Island City in November. That interest has returned over the last few weeks. Brookfield, which owns the Two Manhattan West towers and another at Five Manhattan West, where Amazon is already a tenant, denied through a spokesman that it was leasing to the Seattle company. But multiple sources point to the company's strict confidentiality agreement as a potential reason. At 2 Manhattan West, Amazon is eyeing space at the top of the tower, and the only issue is that the building to be located on 31st Street and 9th Avenue won't be ready for tenants until 2022. 1 Manhattan West, by contrast, will be ready for tenants to move in this fall, including a quarter of a million square feet of space in the middle of a 67-story tower. The 250,000-square-foot space won't be available long-term, however, but could satisfy Amazon's space needs until 2 Manhattan is ready. Amazon also is considering space in the U.S. Post Office building across the street known as the James A. Farley Building, a Vornado development that will boast office space across five levels and will be ready for tenants next May. Amazon's renewed focus on Manhattan so soon after dropping its plan for Queens is an apparent rebuke to the politicians who helped scuttle Amazon's plan to build a 4-million-square-foot campus in Long Island City. And of course, Long Island City is represented by Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Queens residents overwhelmingly supported the plans for the 25,000 new jobs with an average wage of $150,000 a year, despite protests from Ocasio-Cortez and other politicians over the $3.2 billion in capital grants and tax incentives. One reason is that every job that Amazon brings to the area would have a multiplier effect of at least five or more other local jobs, including local coffee shops, dry cleaners, food franchises, and other activities. Manhattan, by contrast, will barely register the growth. Frankly, that kind of activity gets lost in Manhattan. The Long Island City deal would also have seen Amazon invest in a 600-seat public school, a workforce development and a training space, an artist workspace, and 150,000 square feet of public open space, among other projects, which is now lost. The investment in Long Island City was going to create a whole cluster of activity around it. No one is going to have that same impact in Manhattan unless you go to Upper Manhattan. So what does Bill de Blasio have to say about this? Mayor Bill de Blasio is just giving Amazon the cold shoulder now, saying that the e-tailing giant won't get any help from the city if they close on plans to move to Manhattan's west side. Look, if Amazon decides, as Google did, and as many other tech firms have, that they're going to expand their presence in New York City, that's their choice. It doesn't surprise me at all. But again, they're going to have to do it on their own. I have not had any discussions with them. You know, we are very jaded now after having made a full agreement that I thought was a fair agreement that they just walked away with in the dead of night. They have not spoken to me. They have not reached out to me. But if they do something on their own and it adds jobs, well, that's fine. The mayor was addressing the New York Post exclusive report Monday that the tech giant had been in negotiations with landlords of two new skyscrapers located one block west of Penn Station. Amazon is shopping for office space at the recently constructed One Manhattan West and its soon-to-be-completed sister project, Two Manhattan West, after canceling a deal to open a second headquarters in Queens. You know, the whole thing is that the politicians were under two pressures. There were two factors in why the deal in Long Island City broke up. The unions objected to the fact that there would be no unionization of Amazon employees. That's one reason. And the other reason was that the congresswoman thought that the $3 billion of rebate subsidies was available today and it was in the city's hand and it could be better spent elsewhere, not realizing that that money was really a rebate in reduction in tax to Amazon. She had it all wrong. The following is strictly my own opinion. It does not represent the views of my colleagues or anyone else. Hey, Mayor Bill de Blasio, get with it. Help Amazon get located in Astoria, Queens. The people want them. And if you can do it, it will help your bid to be president. You can write a book, The Art of the Deal, version 2.0. Hey, Marty, now that you moved, between your double-sized equipment racks, your product test workbench, and your penchant for spilling coffee on the floor all the time, what kind of flooring are you installing in your man cave?
Floors aren't what they used to be. Well, some are, I guess. Bare concrete floors are still just that. The same goes for dirt floors, carpets. Substantially the same, but a lot more synthetics and polymers are in them and have been in decades past. But there are hundreds of kinds of wood floors that aren't wood at all, or only a little bit wood. Linoleum isn't the only recipe out there for rolled-out floors, and even the idea of what goes down has more variety, from rolls to planks to tiles and beyond. Does it matter what a floor is made of or how it goes down or how it's made? I'm not a flooring expert. I'm still learning. But my starting point is not on the manufacturing side of the topic. I deal with some very human factors, like what would make me upset or angry if the floor wasn't doing something I want or expect it to do? What would make me say, phooey, this is absolutely not the right choice for my floor? Just for reference, and with no third party's contribution, meaning no expertise involved, of course, just me, here's my personal list of questions that I ask when I learn about new choices in flooring. In my bare feet, is it cold like granite or warm like wood? When noise comes from within the room, does the flooring enhance it, reduce it, or have no effect? What about the noise coming through the floor? Is it enhanced, unaffected, or reduced? For what spills is the floor wet immune? Is it damaged by water, by food spills, oils, solvents, or other things? Is it drop immune, meaning that if I drop something heavy on it, will that create dents or cracks? What is its serviceable life expectancy in years? Are there any features to the flooring that create either comfort or discomfort? How does it arrive? Meaning, does it arrive in rolls or tiles or planks or in some other way? Is installing it a reasonable DIY, do-it-yourself project for a careful klutz, or will a contractor be required? Sometimes there needs to be a layer of something between the flooring and the subflooring boards underneath. The category is called underlayment. So is there any mandatory underlayment? Any recommended or strongly suggested underlayment? Or is it okay with no underlayment? What are the trade-offs? Will long-term exposure to sunlight, even through windows, make it fade? To what extent do wear patterns become visible, especially in heavy traffic areas like doorways? I remember an old W.C. Fields movie in which his wife, who has been pushing a broom since the beginning of the scene, complains, "No matter how much I sweep, there's still more dirt on the floor." To which Fields replies, "That's because it's a dirt floor." Dirt is a dramatically less popular option for floors these days, but other classic alternatives are also on the decline. Purchases of carpeting of any kind are down. Purchases of classic roll linoleum, down. Classic tile, where there really are separate little tiles with grout between them, also down. Wood flooring is holding its own. But the multiple categories of flooring that look like wood are having a heyday. That's where my list of questions comes into play. Many of the flooring choices that look like wood feel as cold as stone to bare feet. Many are slippery, even dangerously so. Many wear too quickly, but rather than go through the many and many and many, many more, let me bring your attention to the flooring technology that makes me the happiest. It's called Rigid Core LVT. LVT is trade jargon for luxury vinyl tile, and I can understand why they would rather have you think about LVT than about the word vinyl. Vinyl is associated with the linoleum category. If you're being rigorous, there's no vinyl in linoleum, but the flooring that has since taken its place is called vinyl because it's based on polyvinyl chloride, yes, PVC. Put that out of your mind when I talk about Rigid Core LVT. Just doesn't count. Rigid Core LVT comes in rigid planks with tongue and groove interlocking edges. This is not a single layer of anything. It's a nicely engineered and well-crafted composite structure. Its central core is a very high-density polyurethane foam. Remember me talking about polyurethane foam as an insulator? In this construct, that's one of the roles it plays and may explain why this flooring feels as warm as wood to bare feet. Texturing on the surface is another part of that. As a core layer, while that is a primary source of rigidity, it's still a foam and can handle most shock impacts without cracking. And it does all that despite being just 4 millimeters thick. An executive at Tarkett, one of the manufacturers in the category, told me of a demo where a guy was dribbling a ball on it. Get this, it was a bowling ball. Dribbling a bowling ball and no damage. Did I say all that? There's more than absorbing impact. It also absorbs noise. And wait a second. The layers outside the core include a layer with the print of the pattern you see, most popularly a wood grain, plus a see-through polyurethane wear layer, and sometimes a resiliency layer on the bottom, like a rubber sheet, that also helps absorb noise. But the whole plank, still less than a quarter inch thick. And together, it's heat resistant, resists solar fading, slip resistant, repels water. I don't think there's anything you can do that will warp it. And it resists scratches, scuffs, abrasions, and most household sources of stains from spills or pet accidents. The Rigid Core LVT that I'm putting in my office space is from Tarkett ProGen, where the heavy racks roll, because ProGen can handle 2.5 tons per square inch of pressure without denting or rutting. And an upcoming product from them, NewGen, is a lot like ProGen, but for most of the rest of the floor. The biggest difference is that the wear layer of the NewGen is 12 mils thick, while the wear layer on the ProGen is 20 mils thick. Across all of the Rigid Core LVT brands, the selections that are going into homes tend to be based on wood tones, from grays through browns. Lighter tones are more popular in the American West, medium tones in the Midwest, a mixed bag along the eastern seaboard, and reddish oak in New England. Me? I'm still choosing. Next time, I'll be talking about tools and telling you about the ones I find especially useful as we bring my idea of what it should be to the original skin and bones of this new-to-us 40-year-old house.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. The following are computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open free to the public. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on Ada's driverless cars, Thursday, June the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their meeting on Friday, June 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing has a presentation on Apple seeds and Apple devices, Tuesday, June 11th. Meeting time is 2 p.m., and it's held at the Ewing Senior and Community Center, 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Kingsbite Computer Club meets Tuesday, June the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn, New York. New York Amateur Computer Club has their general meeting on Thursday, June the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at NYU Silver Building at 32 Waverly Place in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group has a meeting on Friday, June the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, out in Old Westbury Campus, Old Westbury, New York. Princeton PC Users Group has a meeting on Tuesday, June the 25th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. And Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, June the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. If you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.